Becoming Jefferson's People. Reinventing the American Republic in the 21st Century. Written by Clay S. Jenkinson. Narrated by the author.
Dedication. For Catherine, Missouri, now 10, heart of my hearts, soul of my soul. May the American Republic recover in time for you to enjoy the bloom. Everything I do is for you. How to use this book. Thomas Jefferson. I am persuaded myself that the good sense of the people will always be found to be the best army. They may be led astray for a moment, but will soon correct themselves. The people are the only censors of their governors, and even their errors will tend to keep these to the true principles of their institution. To punish these errors too severely would be to suppress the only safeguard of the public liberty. The way to prevent these irregular interpositions of the people is to give them full information of their affairs through the channel of the public papers, and to contrive that those papers should penetrate the whole mass of the people. The basis of our governments being the opinion of the people, the very first object should be to keep that right. And were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers, or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. Jefferson to Edward Carrington, January 16, 1787. I wrote this slender book to encourage a national conversation about the future of America. Like hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of others, I deplore the shallowness, corruption, and frivolousness of our national politics, the puniness of our national attention span, and the inanity of what passes for popular culture in the United States at the beginning of the 21st century. It squares not at all with what I learned in civics classes in my youth, nor with the idealism that I felt and was made to feel as a child growing up in America in the 1960s and 70s. For all of their childish partisanship, our two national political parties are virtually identical in essential respects. They are, in my view, both Hamiltonian parties, the Greater Hamiltonian Party and the Lesser Hamiltonian Party. Nor is it clear that our official constitutional culture really governs the United States. From a Jeffersonian point of view, we are in the midst of a fundamental national crisis, and yet we seem not to be talking about it in any meaningful way. The sorry state we have descended into has produced widespread cynicism and apathy. It is almost impossible to convince anyone that the people of the United States still govern themselves in any meaningful sense, or that our representatives want to do the right thing, or that their actions would make a difference even if they were committed to the Commonwealth. There is a very widespread belief that things are bad and that they are going to get worse, not better. Surely, a once great republic deserves better than this. I was trained in the public humanities arena as represented by the National Endowment for the Humanities and its state affiliates, partners, they now like to be called, National Public Radio, and Public Television. My great mentor, Everett C. Albers of the North Dakota Humanities Council, taught me that it is a mistake to conclude that the American people are as shallow and disengaged as they might seem to be. Everett believed, and after addressing public audiences thousands of times, I agree, that the American people are intelligent, sensible, concerned about their world, and hungry for intelligent discourse, and that they would respond favorably to more humanities discussions if they were offered them in attractive ways. If this is true, that beneath the surface cynicism there is substantial and widespread willingness to engage in a national conversation about the future, then it is of some urgency that we find vehicles and forums for that conversation. This book invites us to dream again about a Jeffersonian Republic. In calling for a national conversation, I have in mind a range of activities, not all of which require the entire population to be engaged at the same time. If everyone who reads this book will initiate discussions of America's identity and place in the world at the workplace water cooler, with his or her spouse and family, among close friends while waiting in line at the restaurant or the movie, in email with one's faraway friends, on the bus, while walking the dog, or while taking a postprandial walk, the dialogue might spread until it embraced a substantial percentage of the American public. I also urge you to host dinner parties for your friends and colleagues, and during them to initiate thoughtful conversations which resemble the salon culture that Jefferson found so satisfying during his Paris years, 1784 to 89. Raise these questions in church, with your book club, in classrooms, and during sojourns in nature. Put these questions to the politicians who venture into your midst to ask for your support. Write letters to the editor. Post your thoughts on the internet. It may be that at some point these local conversations will coalesce into a coordinated national conversation. That would be useful, but it would present severe challenges to the integrity of the conversation. The future of the free world cannot be settled in sound bites between commercials for diet soda and cars and Girls Gone Wild videos. But national media attention, however inadequate, might inspire more individuals and groups to undertake the right kind of conversation in Jeffersonian pockets throughout the country. In other words, the conversation can be national without having to be conducted on Larry King Live. In a sense, such a discussion would amount to the generational constitutional convention that Jefferson advocated. Jefferson argued that no single generation should fail to reinvent America and to raise the fundamental questions of civilization and to create its own civic arrangements. Jefferson believed that a nation that governs itself according to an ancient and venerable constitution was almost certainly hidebound and at odds with the actual dynamics of civilization. As the 21st century begins, we need to ask ourselves who we are, what we stand for, what we care about, how we would like to be perceived by our friends and enemies, what role we should play in the world, and how we would like to organize our public spaces. Ideally, the result of such a national conversation would be that a new political party, or at least political persuasion, would rise spontaneously from the sovereign, the American people, and displace the sordid enterprise that passes for our national political culture. Because there is no true alternative to the center-right way things operate under our two-party system, countless Americans have become disaffected, disillusioned, and I think literally diseased. The people need a new vehicle for their idealism and a new voice for their concerns about their beloved country. In writing this book, I have no delusions of grandeur or fantasy that it will have profound influence. But I do believe that the first steps towards national renewal must take place soon, or we will be beyond redemption. And even if such conversations do not change the course of human events, they certainly will change individual lives. This book is designed to inspire my fellow citizens to become Jeffersonians and to help create a new Jeffersonianism in America. It is my conviction that everyone who leads a more Jeffersonian life will be more fulfilled, happier, more productive, and more influential. I also believe that people who become Jeffersonians because they wish to live well turn out, as if by magic, to be the natural leaders in all the walks of their lives. In other words, we seek the Jeffersonian persuasion in our private pursuit of happiness, but it has important and wholly positive social ramifications too. I have attempted here to explore what a Jeffersonian outlook might be at the beginning of the 21st century. Those who are looking for a balanced assessment of Jefferson's strengths and weaknesses will not find it here. I have written about these questions elsewhere. This book emphasizes Jefferson's idealism, his republicanism, his commitment to reason and good sense, and his life as a Renaissance man and an exemplar of the Enlightenment. In other words, this book emphasizes Jefferson's positive vision for the American Republic. I do not wish to be perceived as somehow in denial about the dark side of Jefferson's life and character. I am fully aware that Jefferson was a slave owner, a racist, an apartheidist, a perpetuator of slavery into the American West, and, probably, the father of several of Sally Hemings's children. I know that Jefferson advocated Indian removal policies that barely distinguish him from his successor, Andrew Jackson, and that there were times, admittedly few, when he fantasized about the extinction of at least some portions of Indian America. I realize that Jefferson had a patronizing attitude toward women in public life, and that his preference for women who exhibited that softness of disposition which is the ornament of her sex and the charm of ours, has a grating effect on enlightened men and women of our time. I know that some historians regard Jefferson's intensely selfish relationships with his two adult daughters as psychologically claustrophobic, and arguably worse. I know that Jefferson was a profligate spender who died helplessly in debt. I know, too, that Jefferson had a Machiavellian streak that led him to fight unscrupulously to defeat his enemies in the Federalist Party between 1790 and 1800, and that this included paying James Callender to write ugly nonsense about the Adams administration. I know that Jefferson can be shown to have, at one time or another, advocated prosecution of opposition newspapers, censorship, and an erosion of the Fourth Amendment, that he prejudiced the Aaron Burr treason trial, and that he wrote a bill of attainder while serving as the wartime governor of Virginia. There is more, and it is not admirable. By now, it is clear to everyone that the man, Thomas Jefferson, was not always equal to the ideals he so beautifully espoused. We are witnessing the ex post facto tragedy of Thomas Jefferson, if by tragedy we mean that a great individual is destroyed not by impersonal forces of destiny, but by unresolved energies in his own character. The fall of Thomas Jefferson poses a twofold danger to our republic. First, some now refuse to listen to Jefferson because they cannot stomach what they perceive to be his inconsistencies or, as extremists put it, his contemptible hypocrisies. They have stopped listening to Jefferson's Enlightenment pronouncements because they cannot help but deconstruct them in light of Jefferson's sometimes deplorable actual behavior in the world. Second, and much worse, some believe that the ideals that Jefferson espoused are inherently problematic, even meaningless, and that Jefferson's profound inconsistencies signify not just the measure of his personal failures, but the essential hollowness of his ideals, or for that matter, any Enlightenment ideals. This seems to me to be the veriest nonsense. The Enlightenment's ideals, for all of their seeming superficiality, have revolutionized the world and bettered life on earth in undeniable and measurable ways. No people who enjoys the fruits of the Enlightenment, the rule of law, secular education, bills of rights, separation of church and state, the sanctity of contract, the apotheosis of science, free press, and free inquiry, would ever choose to go back to something more fundamentalist. Jefferson was closer to the Enlightenment's ideals than most people of his time. Perhaps some of his friends and heroes were closer to those ideals than Jefferson. Those ideals matter, and when we are our best selves, and when America is its best self, those ideals inspire the entire world with their breathtaking clarity and dignity. If Jefferson is now perceived to have failed, we are free to judge him and even dismiss him personally. But the ideals that he espoused will continue to be the standard of personal character, the pursuit of happiness, and the purposes of civilization forever. Jefferson knew this. His willingness to articulate the universal from within the messier world of actual life in 18th century Virginia, or Philadelphia, or Paris, is in fact the foundation of his greatness. I believe that the United States needs a new infusion of what might be called clarified or updated Jeffersonianism. At the very least, we need a new generation of Jeffersonians. This book is my modest attempt to define and inspire that national conversation. Clay Jenkinson, Marmot, North Dakota. A Jeffersonian Renewal for America, a Call for a Second American Enlightenment. Thomas Jefferson, what a stupendous, what an incomprehensible machine is man, who can endure toil, famine, stripes, imprisonment, and death itself in vindication of his own liberty, and the next moment be deaf to all those motives whose power supported him through his trial, and inflict on his fellow man a bondage 1 hour of which is fraught with more misery than ages of that which he rose in rebellion to oppose. Jefferson to Jean-Nicolas Dumesnier, June 1786. Jefferson has been dead since July 4, 1826. He lived on the other side of the Industrial Revolution, the other side of the Civil War, the other side of the emergence of the United States as a world power, the other side of the Marxist and Freudian divides, on the other side of the Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965, and the other side of the pell-mell peopling of the American continent in the 19th and 20th centuries. Some of what he believed, the possible racial inferiority of African Americans, the primarily domestic destiny of women, has been resoundingly discredited. Many of his ideas made sense in his own time and place when, in Jefferson's terms, the continent appeared to be a vast tabula rasa waiting to be inscribed with whatever civilization the American people could agree to create. But those same ideas are harder to maintain now that we have become an urban, industrial, consumerist world empire. Jefferson's profound agrarianism, for example, is still perceived by many as the path the American people ought to have taken, but since we did not take that path, there is little point in pretending that a nation of family farmers is still a possibility. The last thing Jefferson would have wanted would be to be remembered as the champion of lost causes. Jefferson was a flexible visionary, a dynamic rather than a static thinker, and he preferred to envision the future rather than cling to the ways of the past. One of his mottos was, "Nil desperandum," nothing is to be despaired of in America, and we are never to permit ourselves to be enslaved by the artifices of civilization. It is certain that stupendous advances in our technologies, from refrigeration and automobiles to the World Wide Web and the electronic economy, have worked revolutionary changes in American civilization, and that these changes render many of Jefferson's ways and ideas inapplicable to our lives at the beginning of the 21st century. For example, the Founding Fathers, particularly the author of the Second Amendment, the cautious and pacific James Madison, would probably think differently about guns at a time when an uninformed, uneducated, uncivil, and unsupervised individual with crack in his veins and a chip on his shoulder can possess a weapon that fires 100 bullets in less than a minute. With a modicum of careful reading, it is possible to determine what the historical figure Thomas Jefferson believed. He was, after all, both prolific and astonishingly articulate. It is more fruitful and more challenging to try to determine what Jefferson might make of our world and what parts of his vision of America are still applicable 200 years later. So what endures of a Jeffersonian worldview at the beginning of the 21st century? Acknowledging the obvious fact that we are no longer a pre-industrial nation with a small and relatively homogeneous population, and that Jefferson would have been the least likely of the Founding Fathers to cling to the systems of his own time and place, how does a modern Jeffersonian see the world? Trying to figure that out is the purpose of this book. Self-reliance. Thomas Jefferson. If you always lean on your master, you will never be able to proceed without him. It is a part of the American character to consider nothing as desperate, to surmount every difficulty by resolution and contrivance. In Europe, there are shops for every want. Its inhabitants, therefore, have no idea that their wants can be supplied otherwise. Remote from all other aid, we are obliged to invent and execute, to find means within ourselves, and not to lean on others. Jefferson to Martha Jefferson, Aix-en-Provence, March 28, 1787. First, a Jeffersonian believes in self-reliance. We may not be able to subsist outside of Hamiltonian institutions any longer, but every Jeffersonian American is aware of how morally and politically compromising it is to be so dependent on transnational corporations, foreign resources, and centralized government for our daily survival. Good Jeffersonians understand their technical, political, and moral relationship to the grids that deliver their food, shelter, electricity, fuel, clothing, and gadgets. An understanding of the supply lines of our civilization is in itself liberating, because knowledge is always preferable to ignorance, and an understanding of the ways systems work at least invites the possibility of action and liberation rather than passivity. A Jeffersonian resists the dependencies of modern life at least in some symbolic way. Jeffersonians grow something, raise some of their own food perhaps, if only a few tomatoes or pears, plant flowers in a window box, nurture a few vines and perhaps press a few grapes. Jefferson was certain that placing one's hands in the earth was one of the keys to humility and human happiness. Perhaps we cannot, like Jefferson, dance the minuet, read Homer and Plutarch in the original Greek, design a Palladian villa, invent a revolutionary plow, and write a state paper of global importance. But a Jeffersonian attempts to cultivate a range of practical life skills that signify the will to achieve independence. A Jeffersonian takes pride in knowing how to do things, weld, perhaps, or plumb, bind books, fire a kiln, change the oil, build a desk, sew, quilt, make jelly, design a website, or perhaps build a telescope. In the face of the dependencies and structural degradations of modern life, these are, of course, merely symbolic declarations of independence. But the Jeffersonian undertakes them because each gesture of independence invites the next, and each tends to build confidence in the proposition that we become more completely human to the extent that we replace a money economy with one based on competence and gumption. The great Jeffersonians get off the grid to the extent possible without becoming silly or primitive. There are Jeffersonians who produce their own water and power supplies, who build their own houses, and who live with minimal contact with the internal combustion engine and its vast enabling infrastructure. These last free men and women are to be admired, if not actually imitated, because in Jefferson's words, they keep alive that sacred fire which otherwise might disappear from the earth.